Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. Mike Pesca in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So we're living in a time when one of the biggest and I think most accurate critiques of Washington dysfunctionality is that too many people have the power to thwart, and that is in fact their only power. The need for supermajorities, the presence of holds, senatorial holds, keeping legislation away from up and down votes. This is the sort of critique that gets widespread agreement when you bring it up. And yet there's Rand Paul being celebrated for essentially an undemocratic act. And I get why. You have to give it to him. It was an important issue, bringing to the fore a conversation about drones and having the conversation in a way that was dramatic and focused attention. And even the White House acknowledged eventually that drone use is an important debate to have. Rand Paul also had this way of speaking onto himself, sort of like a cascading effect. Actually, that's what our producer put together here. Let's listen to a little Paul.
Until the alarm is sounded from coast to coast,
our Constitution is important.
And I have no intention of killing Americans. But I might.
The point isn't that anybody in our country is Hitler.
That in a democracy, you could someday elect someone who is very evil. I don't rise to oppose John Brennan's nomination simply for the person. I rise today for the princess.
They say Lewis Carroll is fiction. Alice never fell down a rabbit hole. And the White Queen's caustic judgments are not really a threat to your security.
For another 12 hours to try to break Strom Thurmond's record, but I've discovered that there are some limits to filibustering, and I'm going to have to go take care of one of those in a few minutes here.
I guess he meant walking his poodle. I'm not really sure. I think he was channeling Jefferson Airplane in the middle of that with the White Rabbit reference. But, you know, that whole filibuster harkened back to the image of Jimmy Stewart, or if you want to go nonfiction, those glorious days of filibusters gone by. Though if you look really hard at the filibusters gone by, you find at the top of the list, as Rand Paul mentioned there, Strom Thurmond, who's clearly on the wrong side of history as he was filibustering against the Civil Rights Bill. So maybe Strom Thurmond wasn't the Babe Ruth of filibusters. It was sort of the Barry Bonds. The question about Rand Paul and the questions that he raises are questions beyond the very issue of drones. But what's going on in Washington? To join us to dissect all this is Glenn Thrush. He writes for Politico, where he's the senior White House reporter. Hello, Glenn.
Hey, how's it going? Now I got White Rabbit in my head.
Yeah, one pill makes you larger.
One Paul makes you larger.
There you go. There's a hashtag. Not that we were lacking for hashtags during this whole thing. Was the White House taken by surprise by the filibuster?
Yeah, I mean, this is Barack Obama's power move, the whole populist thing, right? Isn't Obama's entire second term strategy predicated on sort of going around the standard Washington chatter to the people directly? I mean, look, I was listening to your intro. I mean, the one really paradoxical thing about this filibuster is Rand Paul was up there advocating a position that about 10% of Republicans support. So this is a filibuster that represented a position that was an atypical issue for the Republican Party, and Lindsey Graham and John McCain took to the floor yesterday to savage him about it. So even in this shining moment, and you were monitoring the Twitter sphere when Rand Paul was there, I mean, this was like, you know, trumpeted as this great Republican resurgence. The problem is this is an issue that more Democrats probably support Paul on than Republicans.
Right. And that's what's so interesting, that if you looked at the list of issues where Rand Paul stands on things, I mean, he could have filibustered the Clean Air Act or the Campaign Reform Act or the 14th Amendment or the proposed assault weapons ban. I mean, these are all stances that he takes. Yet he chose to filibuster on this issue. Do you think it was a calculation? Well, obviously it was a calculation. But was part of his calculation, let's do something with bipartisan support specifically?
Well, I think, you know, this is clearly, you know, you have to look at the vehicle here. And the vehicle is the Brennan nomination, which, as you know, is fairly controversial on the left because of the drone stuff and also because of some unanswered questions about Brennan's involvement in late Clinton-era stuff. But the issue here for Rand Paul is, you know, this is a guy who clearly has his eye on 2016 and wants to kind of pick up the coalition that his father had. So in that regard, it's calculation. But I have to tell you, it was cool. I thought it was pretty cool for the simple reason that usually these guys don't have the guts to stand up there and actually do this, right? Mitch McConnell, who has been sort of the greatest practitioner, some would say abuser of kind of the pocket filibuster, mm-hmm. requiring these endless cloture votes, was basically forced to take off his PJs, put on a suit, and come down to the floor and support Rand Paul. So in that regard, yes, this does represent, in the larger sense, an undemocratic practice. But like I said before, I mean, it was one of the few instances where you sort of saw a member of the House or Senate almost putting their body and bodily functions on the line for what they believed in.
Yes, with only Milky Ways to sustain them. Although, you know, it's exciting because it's new, and that's the definition of news, and there was an inherent drama to it. If it becomes a common thing, it will get old quick. Will other senators say, hey, wait a minute, this guy's star just rose unbelievably from this one 12-hour stunt. Why don't I hijack the Senate for a little while?
Well, the candidate number one for that would be Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who I like to call the Lone Star Schumer, who piggybacked onto the Rand Paul thing and is a guy who is prone to using sort of theatricality on the floor of the Senate. You recall that he used sort of a slideshow during the Chuck Hagel Chuck Hagel hearings, and he kind of got out of line, and John McCain took a whack at him too. John McCain is turning into the get off my lawn guy in the Senate right now. I don't think it's going to be overused, frankly, because these guys don't want to stand up there for 10 hours. I mean, that really is what's interesting about this. And the reason why this resonates is because this was a guy who was willing to actually do something that was physically uncomfortable for what he believed in.
Right. And speaking of Ted Cruz, here's a question I have, because as Rand Paul is filibustering this issue, I think this exchange between Ted Cruz and Eric Holder took place before, if I'm getting the timeline right. And I think, if I'm hearing it right, Ted Cruz essentially gets the answer eventually from Eric Holder that Rand Paul was demanding. Let's hear this from the Senate testimony.
If this person sitting at the cafe, not doing anything imminently, the use of lethal force would not be appropriate, would not be something...
I find it remarkable that you still will not give an opinion on the constitutionality. Let me move on to the next topic, because we've gone round and round.
Let me be clear. Translate my appropriate to no. I thought I was saying no, all right?
No.
Well, then I am glad. After much gymnastics, I am very glad to hear that it is the opinion of the Department of Justice that it would be unconstitutional to kill a U.S. citizen on U.S. soil if that individual did not pose an imminent threat.
So wasn't that the very question that Rand Paul said he was seeking from the White House, and hadn't the answer then therefore been given as he was doing his filibuster?
Well, it was, but that was a bit of confusing testimony, in part because the New York Times and other organizations had in their hands reports of internal Justice Department documents stating the contrary. And, you know, and the White House, we had this very interesting spectacle of Robert Gibbs, the former press secretary for the White House, saying publicly, he's now an MSNBC contributor, that, you know, he had been informed by Justice Department and Office of Counsel lawyers not to address it publicly when he was at the podium. So, there's a little bit of sleight of hand here. The bottom line is there doesn't seem to be anything in terms of a seriously aggressive domestic drone program at the moment. But there is really the danger, and there is still a great deal of ambiguity on this. And I think, you know, Rand Paul is sort of touching on that. But the larger issue here is, I think, is the Republicans are looking for some opportunity to kind of turn the momentum back from the midterms. I mean the larger issue being politically. I'm not underselling the policy point. And they're looking really for any white knight they can possibly come up with, and Rand Paul is that guy at the moment.
Yeah, and what about Lindsey Graham, who along with John McCain tut-tutted or more vocally disapproved of what Rand Paul was doing? He faces a primary challenge. Could his stance during this hurt him with South Carolina Republicans?
It could, but there was a really interesting report. I think the National Journal had it, citing a Winthrop University poll down there. Only 5%. This tells you how things have fundamentally shifted over the last couple of years. About 5% of South Carolinians. This is Jim DeMint's home state. Remember, self-identify as Tea Party. And Graham's approval ratings back home are in the 60s and 70s, precisely because he's been taking shots at the Obama administration. Graham is a really interesting political operator. So he went after Hagel with both fists. Remember that, and the White House was very, very tough on him as a result of that. That was largely, I mean, I'm not again underselling his objections to Hagel, but that gave him the latitude to work more closely with the White House on issues like immigration and some of this fiscal stuff. And Graham, it turns out, my reporting has shown, it has been the guy who is the open door for Obama's new engagement strategy with Senate Republicans. Graham and McCain, it turns out, have an exceptionally good relationship with the new White House Chief of Staff, Dennis McDonough, who was previously a national security guy. So, Graham has reemerged after a couple of years in hibernation as the most interesting guy in the Senate.
Mike Pesca on WNYC, filling in for Brian Lehrer, talking with Glenn Thrush of Politico. Well, there you mentioned what the White House is doing to reach out. There's some wining and dining literally taking place. Is this will this amount to anything?
Yeah, Obama's a really skinny guy, right? And he seemed to lose weight during the campaign. I think maybe this is part of, like, you know, the fattening part of our program here. I just sent it out that Obama actually had a secret, unreported dinner with the Clintons, Bill and Hillary, on March 1st. So he's having a lot of dinners here. This seems to be like the supper strategy. This is a guy who hasn't been reaching across the aisle very much over the past couple of years. He is diffident and distant, sort of the anti-LBJ. He is not a very tactile legislator. He only spent a short time in the Senate. And I think there was a growing sense, even among some Democrats who wanted him to take a hard line on fiscal stuff, that not talking to this guy, not talking to these other to the opposition, was turning into an unmanageable problem. And I am told that McDonough, again, has been a force inside the White House to get him to abandon this exclusively, quote-unquote, outside strategy of hammering Republicans.
Right, and it can't be bad to engage. How could it be bad to engage? But, you know, when I hear about the glory days of Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan having a scotch, and when I hear Cokie Roberts talking about how when her dad was running the House of Representatives, everyone would stay in town and everyone knew each other and they didn't have to go back home to raise money, so there was just this collegial feeling. You know, I get the impression that the idea that personal relationships can overcome the structure of Washington, which is about going home and leaving town to raise money, which is about these districts that have been drawn up to be, you know, unbelievably safe for unbelievably conservative or unbelievably Democratic candidates. I mean, it just seems to me that if you want to get to the root of the problem, it's like 90-something percent structure and maybe, you know, less than 10% personal dynamics.
I would throw something else in. Yeah, there's structure, personal dynamics, and then I would throw in a third element, which is starting to emerge, and that's circumstance, right? Don't underestimate the divergence between the House Republicans, who are a total mess right now, a failed state, sort of, and the Senate Republicans, who have an eye towards 2014 and 2016 beyond, and are becoming are much more representative of the quote-unquote national party of Republicans. So you have this interesting dynamic where the people who are running campaigns for Republicans in 2014 are more intent now on proving the Republicans can function as a governing party than they are of simply opposing Obama. So you have this disconnect between the House and Senate. So it is this circumstance, this turning of the wheel, that Obama is being responsive to. So it's not merely an issue of redistricting because obviously there's no redistricting in the Senate. It's insulated from that. It's not just these structural issues. It's a matter of commonality of interest. And I think, to everyone's surprise, and this sort of happened over a 48-hour period, I think Obama and some of these moderate, more moderate, shall I say, Senate Republicans have realized there is a convergence of interest.
But if so many, if Washington's a train and so many members of Congress and the Senate have the have their hand on the brakes, or that's the only power they have, the ability to pull the emergency brakes, how much can whatever Obama forms with the Senate actually become law if the House sees itself as, you know, standing athwart history and saying no?
Well, look, there's a certain water in the bucket effect here. If there's a hole in the bucket, the water gets out of the bucket. It doesn't have to be a big hole. And John Boehner, in a wink and nod kind of way, when John Boehner says the Senate needs to get off its ass, which is what he said last week,
mm-hmm.
what he's talking about is, hey, guys, you get it passed there first, and then we'll figure out a path through the House. This just happened last week on the Violence Against Women Act, which passed again in violation of the Hastert rule, the majority of the majority rule, which seemed to have been ironbound until about 2 months ago, that passed with a majority of Democrats. So there seems to be a sense that if you can get it passed in the Senate, that creates ample political pressure for Boehner to go around what is called regular order in the House and put it on the floor. And as you recall, sort of memorably, right after the campaign, Boehner told his troops, I'm not going to cut any more deals with the president. Everything's going to go through regular order. That has turned out to be quite the opposite. So the only strategy available to the White House right now is to go through the Senate and then just use the brute force of a bipartisan coalition to push something through.
So where are we on ending the sequester, via grand bargain or any other means?
Here's the secret about the sequester. It is the least catastrophic catastrophe. And we have had these last-minute deals to avert these very, very, very serious situations, fiscal cliff, the debt ceiling stuff. The sequester, it turns out, has just enough in it for everybody that there is not a great incentive for people to roll it back anytime soon. I think there's going to be some piddling around the edges, but to a certain extent, both sides get enough out of this that there isn't the drive to roll it back. We're going to see a continuing resolution popping up fairly soon, and we're obviously going to have to deal with the debt ceiling thing. There is not an appetite on either side to turn both of those very consequential battles into a war of the worlds. The sequester is a much less consequential matter. It may have an impact on the larger economy, and I think it's going to have a devastating impact on the poor. I think HUD and Section 8 vouchers are going to get nailed. But it is not bad enough to warrant a large-scale bipartisan deal.
So then was it poorly designed? Instead of being the sword of Damocles, is it the Nerf bat of Damocles?
Nerf. I'm sorry, man. That was good.
Yeah, yeah.
I would urge you to write that one down.
I had it chambered for about 3 minutes, yeah.
It sounds like a book.
Yeah.
I think it's more like the butter knife of Damocles.
Uh-huh.
No one would have proposed it if they didn't have some sense that it would be palatable at the end of the day. And, Washington loves nothing more than being forced to do something they don't want to do.
Let's get to one last big tangible issue that is on a lot of people's minds, especially in the New York area, guns. Some legislation just passed committee. Where does the gun issue, automatic weapon ban, any of that, where does that stand?
I think right now we're very much in a very weird kind of backroom limbo here. You had Tom Coburn and Chuck Schumer working on a background check bill, which was scrapped, in my view, over a fairly fig leaf issue for Coburn, which was the production of these paper records, which he feels would represent some great encroachment on the Second Amendment, but really it reflects the pressure the NRA is putting on Coburn. So I'm still fairly sure we're going to see some sort of legislation produced on background checks. I think it is becoming, with every passing day, increasingly unlikely we're going to see something on assault weapons or even magazines. And I think we're going to start hearing again some griping from the gun groups about Obama's delay on this. There is a sense that had he moved even unsuccessfully directly in the wake of Newtown, that would have created some more momentum for this process. But right now, we're just getting farther and farther away from that tragedy, and the emotions are less raw.
Glenn Thrush covers the White House for Politico, has the good sense to laugh at my references. We like him very much. Thank you so much, Glenn.
Take care.
And we'll be back in a minute speaking with a man running for the mayor of this great city, Sal Albanese.